Okay, today is October 23rd, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing to
I'm ready to go if you are.
Do Dave's life story. So let's go. Okay. Where are we going tonight?
We're going to go to northern Scandinavia and the Russian Kola Peninsula. And this all part of a field course that I was invited to be one of the professors or teachers on. It was organized through the University of Lapland in Rovaniemi, Finland. And the my connection there had been largely through a professor there called American Bruce Forbes, who... He was from originally from, oh, he was a part of the Forbes wealth, and grew up in Maine, and so his family was extremely wealthy. But he doesn't acknowledge that connection. I met his dad and mother.
But he was a fellow biologist.
He was a biologist who had organized this field course in collaboration with people from the University of Stockholm in Sweden, and one of the women there from Sweden was Russian, and she had grown up and been educated on the Kola Peninsula. And was an expert on the pollution effects on vegetation and reindeer grazing areas and from the Machagorsk and other big metallurgical mining there. Some of it was copper, some nickel, and other chemicals with a major air pollution, which swept over into Norway and northern Finland and Norway and Sweden and affect reindeer grazing areas too, so especially the lichens. And so she was involved, and her husband was a Swede, I think, and she had her PhD from the work on the Kola Peninsula. And then there was Bruce was one of the instructors. Then there was a professor, a woman who I knew had done a lot of work with reindeer and reindeer, mainly physiology, but also nutrition of reindeer in Finland. And there was another woman who was Swede, and she was on the faculty at Stockholm. And so it was, students from Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia, one from Canada, and one from Netherlands. There had been one tentatively from Alaska, but it didn't work out for her to come. So there was really challenging, and the plan was then to meet in Rovaniemi and spend a couple of days there for the teachers to get to know the students, they did a good job of sort of dividing. Well, this field class was going to last about 10 days, and we'd have a nice bus and a driver from Finland signed to go everywhere, and they'd already made the deals to go into Russia and cross at a point where they normally would not want people to cross, but to go into all these other countries as well and involve local people that are working with, including the Sami, reindeer herding people. So we'd sometimes, and we're doing this the way I like to do field trips. You know, we carried a lot of food with us, and sometimes we wouldn't have, we'd have a place to stay, but we'd have to cook the food, or we would stay at a sort of like a campgrounds where one little, for tourists in northern Sweden or Finland, where they catered to tourists, but that was right after the tourist season, so it was in September, and then they would say, well, you can use the kitchen there if you want, and especially in Finland and Sweden and Norway, they would have they'd have cabins that you could rent, and they'd put us in these cabins and at a reduced rate. And I brought my partner along, Heather McIntyre, and she agreed to take responsibility for organizing food, and she'd experienced to do that. And then they had did they have any other cooks or what? No, I think that we all chipped in, especially seemed like women more than men.
So what year was this?
2000.
Okay.
And so the plan was then we would do this circuit through Finland, northern Finland first, and then I forget whether we did the Norway one first or after the Kola Peninsula, probably after. But I don't really remember that. But at any rate, they had done, and Bruce and the other faculty that were involved there from, and it was supported by the head of Finnish woman at the head of the Arctic Council then. I can't pronounce her last name. She was based right there at that university. She was also a key player in coordinating with other countries. And so it was tied in with connections. And Bruce had funding. Some of it was from NSF, and some was from some support from Russia, and some from Finland and Sweden and Norway to work. He had done a lot of work with in the Jämtland Peninsula with reindeer herding people, and how the oil and gas, it was mainly gas development there, and roads and railroads and pipelines, and how that had all interacted. So, and they wanted, from me, they wanted me because of my experience with the caribou range and habitat and reindeer range vegetation, primarily for that reason, but also because of my experience with the industrial development in North Slope in relationship to a caribou habitat. So when we're in the Kola Peninsula, of course, we had the usual problems crossing the border and things like that we weren't supposed to have, and they had to bribe some of the soldiers with cigarettes to get through successfully, and they had some problems getting out. They wanted to confiscate the laptop of the Swedish guy who tended to be the kind that they envision was a spy of some kind. And anyway, it was a real adventure in the Kola, because we went to this one village, which was where there were some of the reindeer herders living, and then they were herding the reindeer close to that. And so the Russian government had taken some pride that these were people that were still doing this, and this was 2000, of course, was after the liberalization, and these were people that held out and didn't collectivize, and now they were, the Russian government was trying to make up and treat them reasonably well, which wasn't particularly well, but reasonable. And some of these people were, in this local town, were Sami, were like city council, included some of them, and they were interested in this, the transition from the reindeer herding culture into an economic culture, but and still maintain their identity. And that meant education and how education was pulled together, and what are the options for things like tourism and stuff in a positive way for the people, because Sami and in Finland and northern Sweden and Norway had done a pretty good job in this regard. And although the differences were tremendous between countries in their history, but and of course then there were economic aspects of raising the meat and skins and what, and prospecting them, etc. So we got to see a lot of this stuff, and there's this, and that what the faculty organized in a way that about three to four students were assigned to each faculty member, and we were supposed to be mentors of these, and the students had assignments to try to produce a semi-technical paper as a result of this trip, and the subject area that they were going to define in a general way before we left, so they wouldn't do it after the fact. They would work through us. And so part of the things we did when we'd stop someplace for the evening, we'd have a gathering usually in the afternoon, and then maybe one after dinner, to where the students would make short presentations on what what their objectives were and what they expect to find. And as an advisor and mentor, we had some role in interacting. And so I had one Russian woman and who was from the Karelia and had experience with forest reindeer and management a little bit in that area. And then a black guy from Cameroon who was working on a PhD at the University of in Norway near Oslo, of the used to be the Agricultural University, but it's been renamed if it's translated to the Norwegian University of Environmental Sciences. And Walter Walaji is his name, the black guy. And then it was obvious that he was older. He had a wife and kids in Norway, and he was surprisingly making this difficult transition from Africa, West Africa, to both he and his wife had training in forestry. but there was no really future for them there. And so, at any rate, then we would bus and stop in places where we could see. There were wonderful places to stop, like this area between in that case, Finland and Norway and Russia, which was literally, there's one crossing point there, but there's nobody was allowed to live on the Russian side. It was like there was military had control over that. They did allow some, I don't know whether they allowed hunting or not. Probably not. They just didn't want people in there. So this, they'd forced any of the reindeer herders out of there, and it was like no man's land. And it was about 20, 25 kilometers. It's just on the Russian side. And of course, there was a fence there. And it was amazing because without any reindeer, the lichen growth, it was a wintering area for the reindeer, the lichen growth was super abundant. So here you had, we could stop and we had permission to stop, but we weren't supposed to spend any time stopping. And they checked you as you get back out of the zone. And I think that was the main checkpoint when you got through that. And there were guards that you wouldn't let us through the first one, except that we had this pass. But there was this big deal of everybody had to be interviewed separately, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these students and the bus. But we got through there. And then we were pretty free to go wherever we wanted that had been outlined in advance. So we got to see this tremendous pollution. And this woman, Russian woman, she was terrific. She's super sharp, and she knew the whole system and knew people. And, you know, one time we stayed at a research center tied to a university, which was really nice because they had a place for us, a bunkhouse and toilets and things like that, which were pretty upscale for Russian, according to Russian conditions. Not super, but quite passable and nice, and a nicely maintained. It's a lot of log cabins, but a few frame buildings, and some of them were reasonably painted.
And a little more upscale than camping.
And so then, and they took us out and were with some locals to look at some of these big open pit mines, and then pollution and problems, and how they were studied them. And this woman had, you know, could take us to these study plots and stuff and showed us, you know, the different effects, different wetlands and upland sites, different vegetation. And then we stayed in a hotel in Murmansk, which was there's one big, not too expensive hotel that accommodates everybody there. And Russia likes that because they keep an eye on everybody. But they had reasonable restaurant, and they had upscale restaurants in the town that we go out on. One time we got to go out and we could afford to do that. We were warned in advance. You didn't have to do it, but if you wanted to, there you could, you know, get beer and wine and things like that if someone was willing to chip in. And of course, faculty were pretty good at that. So that was a nice party night, but also there were entertainment in these restaurants too, by a lot of, some of it was folk music and dancing, and some performance they had rigged with the Sami people that put on a performance horse. Then we went to the, drove out to the end of this road to a, this town that had been a military camp there, but that was shut down after the dissolution of the Soviet Union because there were just too goddamn many soldiers there. There were still too many when we were there, but and we supposedly had an arrangement where there would be guards to guard the bus, because that was the only secure place. The hotel rooms didn't have any locks on the doors, or they didn't work. And we had, you know, cameras and stuff like that, and some laptops. And so it was a typical thing at that time. We got there, and the guards said, no, they hadn't made a deal with them to be guards, and for another $2,000, I think, they would agree to guard the bus. We didn't. They didn't have $2,000. I mean, everything was the hotel. You know, they had a restricted menu for us because they couldn't afford, and it wasn't that luxurious. It wasn't a tourist hotel at all. And so finally the bus driver said, okay, he's going to sleep on the bus, and he will park the bus so the doors are right up against the building, so they couldn't get in. And that worked. But they were, I mean, they were so pissed, you know, they were, and they thought they had us, you know, and that we had to pay. Right. Otherwise, they'd think they'd rip off things. At any rate, we met at meetings with the people, and when there were translators there, and that we bought, as well as they, well, we had the Russian woman and others who were fluent in Swedish and everything, same like Finnish and Russian and English. And at any rate, that was really interesting, and we got to stop frequently and get out with the students, and I could explain, you know, show the different levels of grazing pressure, and we got a feeling for this whole the Sami culture there, which is so different. Then actually, those were Nenets people there. Yeah, there was some Sami people. We went through their area too in Russia, but these were Nenets people. But their behavior and lifestyle and cultures were very similar and reindeer related. Mm-hmm. And then we went back and across the border slowly. And then we went through northern Sweden and Russia down to Alta, which is...
That's in northern Norway, right?
Yeah, north of Tromsø a little bit. And we got into the reindeer grazing area, and what is it called? The town in... I forgot the name of the town. It's all reindeer herders and sort of a, you know, semi-modern town, but, you know, not unlike towns here with dead snow machines and in the yards of some of them, like Barrow and places like that, and vehicles, of course, because on the road system, and shops and Coca-Cola signs, And so we interacted with the people there, and then we went out and visited some of the grazing areas, and that was good because we knew the history of grazing on these different areas, and that's where Bruce and I were the sort of experts on the lichen growth and what, and Bruce, I'd known for a while, and he was on the board for Arcus at one time, and we worked well as a team with the students, and And a situation like that, you know, if the, sometimes the weather wasn't all that great, it, with a, you know, a little bit of blowing snow and rain. But we had rain gear, and everybody, the weather never seemed to bother anybody. It was nice to get back sometimes in the bus when it was so miserable, but at least we could get out and see things. And
you said it was in September?
Yeah.
And it was a month-long course, or?
No, it was about 10 days, I think.
Oh, okay.
And then, and Alta was nice, because then the Norwegian, the, one of the Norwegian students was based out of there, and so she had connections, and we were, she was good at, as a guide, and they pulled in another Norwegian guy who was with the University of Tromsø and worked a lot with native cultures or the Sami. And he was, it was sort of a little bit of a firebrand, but a really fun guy and very knowledgeable. And so it was overall a very stimulating trip for me, but also for other people that were, everybody that was on the trip, the grad students. The Russians, it took a while for them to get collective as their, rather than be, there's this Russian component of grad students, partly because they're familiar with English wasn't all that good. And so when we had a couple of faculty who could speak Russian, but other than that, we wanted everything to be in English, and they were participants, and when students were, and they had to make presentations. And I really felt for some of them who did, they were doing really good work. A couple of the guys were really good, and but it was difficult for them to make a presentation in English. It's hard enough for grad students to, that are, that's their mother tongue, to do a good presentation, but some of them were good, and I was sure that I felt good that this whole concept of mixing students up from so many different countries and different training, and they responded really positively to that. And Walaji, the black guy, turned out to be already really knowledgeable about reindeer physiology and wild reindeer, as well as domestic, the caribou. In Norway, he was working in that aspect there and had good people that he was working with. And it was, he got interested in, that was probably in Finland when they're talking about insects and harassment and parasites. And he got focused on that. And so he asked me about how to proceed. And I told him, you know, the key people to talk to that were going in Finland with some of the best work on insect harassment and modern techniques and how to deal with that, with not mosquitoes so much as the Russians had more experience with the mosquitoes, but it was the parasitic flies, where they're mm-hmm. using a drug, and they had to round up the animals and give them injection, and pretty effective, and so body weight went way up if you got rid of, mm-hmm. and you got rid of internal parasites at the same time with the gut parasites, which weren't considered very important because they're sort of endemic to all of the animals, but they varied in relation to the health of the animals. At any rate, that was great, and then we ended up in and back in Rovaniemi, finally, and it was, and we had maybe one concluding meeting with students and what before they all went their varying directions, and that was great. And I, we all, I mean, I could continue to contact this Russian woman by email as well as Walaji. And then I ran into him again back in when I was in Oslo and visiting there. And I got to know his whole family, and that was a really tough one for them because she couldn't, and for a black woman to get a job in Norway, virtually impossible. So all she could do is something like house cleaning or something like that. And then they had these two young boys, and one of them had, was it eye problem or something? And they were able to get him coverage. Like in Norway, they didn't want to do this at first because he was coming there with this problem and it was going to cost pretty expensive to deal with. Mm-hmm. And the university insurance wasn't normally going to do this. And the guy was, he had some funding, but everything was so expensive there. And they were living in student housing, but it was cost some big bucks to rent that. But they were determined. And so then he and I continued to focus, and he went ahead and I suggested, because he was making such good progress on the field trip, and I was giving him references and telling what I knew, and had him spend time with especially the people that work with insects in Finland that we stopped, when we stopped there. No, they were in Rovaniemi, that's right, and had a chance to talk to them. So then he suggested I'd be a co-author, and he was going to put together a paper, and so I continued to interact on that, and that paper got published after I got through, and there were about two or three papers published as a result of that trip, directly a result. But then I kept running into Walaji, and then I went to the International Arctic Ungulate Conference, and that was in Finland, I guess. Was it in Finland? Yeah, in Finland, I guess. And Walaji's there, and they put together this panel, the conference organizers, with experts from different countries. He represented Norway, a black guy, and there were good Norwegian people there, and they already felt that he was the best choice, which was pretty impressive because Norwegians aren't particularly, in university, they're not, certainly not racist at all, but immigrants coming down into the cities, you know, a lot of the Norwegians too concerned about diluting the Norwegian blood.
Yeah.
And that's true in Sweden to some extent and as well. So here was Walaji doing this. And so then Walaji completed his PhD there successfully. And he had right away they gave him, got a postdoc position, but the pay was marginal for a guy like him with the family and the kids, and they appreciated that the kids were able to go to school and they were learning. They already were fluent in French, and I don't know whether there was a native language there. French was in Cameroon was a language, and of course Walaji and his, and the kids all had to learn Norwegian,
right.
But they were learning English too, all of them, and so then I kept in touch with him, and he was saying, well, the postdoc is, they can hardly live on that, and there's no, the funding won't last. And so he wondered about the United States, and I said, you got to apply, you got to keep your eyes open, apply for any faculty positions, because you're qualified for faculty positions in Canada too. And he wanted to know about Canada versus Alaska and stuff like that. And all I could do was give him my perspective. And I said, for him, either place is the first thing you can do. Once you get into the system and establish yourself, if you're any good, you'll be able to move to other universities in North America, not just in the United States or Canada. And so, but it's really tough for him. And probably one would think, I don't know whether it's any tougher for a black person, but just there aren't that many blacks into Arctic and subarctic ecology and reindeer and caribou. And it's kind of, well, how can this be possible? At any rate, they were pretty desperate to get out. And so the other alternative, if they have to go back to Cameroon. Mm-hmm. And there, his father had multiple wives, was a pretty influential guy politically, and that's why they both were able to get, where he was able to get a pretty good education, like equivalent of a master's degree there, but at least a master's degree under their system.
Right.
And but there weren't jobs there. So if they went back, I mean, it would be terrible. And the worst case was the kids, and where they needed to have health care and education. And the kids were sharp boys and a lot of fun. And then I think they had a third child, a girl. And so then I heard that, he was corresponding with me and asking about positions that were, he'd seen advertised. And in Canada, there was one at a small university, which I knew a little bit about, near in Quebec, near Montreal. Forgot the name of it, Gaines-Lewis. And there was some, during a good economy in Canada, there were people there doing good ecological work, research funding, but it was primarily, you had to have a heavy teaching load if you're there. So he got the position, and he's able to collaborate and do research with other people that relate to caribou, and mainly caribou now, and other wildlife-related issues. And the guy is so sharp. I mean, he's got this good background now in ecology, and so that was nirvana to get there. And it was French-speaking, which they were already fluent, and so they got, kids could go to good schools and had health care. And then I met him at one conference somewhere, and in the States, I think, or might have been Canada, but he was presenting paper, and he just was publishing like mad on his doctoral stuff and others from Norway. So he had, was doing everything right for a young professor, but it was, we were entering an era of poor economy, and that university wasn't, research was not their strength. And so he told me when I saw him, he was I had a heavy teaching load, just barely able to make it, and he worked as a taxi driver at night to make enough to so they could live reasonably well. And then I met him again, the most recent, it was last year, in 2013, I was asked to be an external reviewer of a Canadian, something of National Science Foundation, the Canadian mm-hmm. one. And there was a special research program that the University of Saskatchewan had applied for, and there are two co-PIs. One was a woman who had been here and as a postdoc botanist, worked with Terry Chapin and is top-notch. And so she'd get a full-time faculty position there. And the other one was, I don't know whether she was Canadian originally, she might have been, but the other one was a guy who had done his doctoral work on horses, feral horses, they live on an island and off the coast of one of the maritime provinces. Hmm. I didn't even know that it existed, but he did a really good research there, a lot of marked and radio-collared stuff and aerial surveys, and it was a very popular kind of thing because it didn't deal with controversial things like caribou and Canada can be, especially woodland caribou, controversial. At any rate, the research project was a megabuck project that would be a focus on woodland caribou and mining development, uranium mining mainly. And the mining companies were going to, it would be they were partners in this research, and they were kicking in a lot of money to pay for the radio collars that would be used and some helicopter time, which were big ticket items. And the vegetation component of it was designed by this woman who had been here as a postdoc, Jill Johnson, I think it is her name. And the committee included Robert Wallace. He's already become, recognized as this good guy. He's still at this university, and he'd like to move to another one, and he probably will eventually. But there was one guy from Alberta that I had remembered from meeting a long time ago when I was at some conference there, and he was expert on caribou, woodland caribou, I think. And then there was a couple of others, about three, and there must have been about five or six of us. And then the woman, senior woman, a biologist who was working for the, she was the one who was the examiner for the Science Foundation. So I was a little suspect when I got there, and they sent me the proposal first, I think, and I looked it over, and they paid me to fly down there and put me in the hotel in Saskatoon. It was all there at the University of Saskatchewan. I'd been there once or twice as an external examiner for PhD thesis, I think, and maybe one conference there. But it's a good university, but I hadn't been in Saskatchewan for a long time, and the oil wealth there from the tar sands. Yeah. A big issue, although this area, the study area, was not tar sands area, but it where the uranium mines are, and the uranium mines have a good record of their in remote areas where there's no roading to get there, and they're happy it's that way. And then they sometimes local roads and a local road to a native village, and the natives there living in northern Saskatchewan in these remote places, they want to maintain their traditional lifestyle, but they don't. They need money, and they need some income. And so the mines have done a pretty good job of employing young guys, and have done a pretty good job of trying to minimize environmental impact. And their whole approach was, our footprint is so small that we're not having any effect. And yet the woodland caribou are an endangered species. And it sounded, pretty good. Here's mining showing that, and this research will show that the caribou, woodland caribou, are doing fine there. It's not, mining is not going to have any significant impact. Well, that's sort of a hypothesis. And then the guy doing that part of the study, the guy who did the PhD on horses, I mean, he didn't have any background at all with the caribou and the woodland caribou or the habitat. That was the worst case. He didn't have an understanding of the habitat, and yet he was coming out on top in terms of the first PI and Jill Johnson, probably because he had been there a year longer than her. And it was like, there were two of them where we had to, meet with them, and they answer all these questions. And there was nothing, no native input in this. And I raised this question, and then they said, oh, no, we'll interact with the guy in the faculty that teaches native stuff and is a good guy. He's got a lot of experience. And I said, well, what about the natives themselves? There's no need for input. And this woman who was representing Canada, she wanted to give them this approval of this proposal. And we met with her and sometimes without her, but and she was, when we met with her and raising our concerns, I mean, she was pretty good and objective and very knowledgeable woman. But it was like, this really wasn't a serious thing. They can build this contact with the natives in through this one professor. He wouldn't be a part of the project, but he would be, advisor and what. I kind of understand that. And I had to qualify things saying, I realize I have a different bias because I'm used to U.S. and this is Canada. But I thought that there would always be native participation when you're in native lands and doing something like that. And it was like, well, he can probably upscale that thing. Well, anyway, when it came down to a vote, we all approved the botanical work. It was well designed. It needed some improvement, and she needed more independence from the other one. Because it was like she would get second play on transportation and things like that, whereas she needed it. And it was preliminary. You got to do the botanical stuff first. And what's good to put radio collars on the caribou, and you can tell where they are, but you don't know what the vegetation is. And they weren't, he wasn't forward thinking. And Jill said that, the budget is so limited for her because most of it was on the going to his side of the operation. And his argument was, well, yeah, but they're paying, the mining company is paying for the collars and stuff. And he didn't feel that, you know, that was any concern that, and they were also advisors on the proposal too, the mining interest. They were sharp guys. They were there when we were discussing these things, and they'd come and answer these questions. That they had done their homework on the technology of tracking animals, et cetera, et cetera. And they were pretty, you know, well, if this is a problem, we can make another snow machine available, although they hadn't done much planning for winter work at all. And I, since I had been a consultant on a project for the governor of Manitoba just next door that had to do with power lines and how it would affect caribou several years earlier, I had more knowledge of the woodland caribou and their use of that area than any of those people did. I couldn't believe that. And the people, the guys from Alberta, looked like they'd been bought by the, to some extent, by the oil industry. Well, at any rate, when it came to a vote, we said we could okay that the botanical part, but the others was, and that was mainly me arguing this, and Olaji, I was a little disappointed with him, and then I realized Harry was a black guy on this committee in Canada, and he would be going to the same agency to get funding, and so he wanted to agree with the agency people as much as possible, and didn't want to challenge things. And our, even in informal discussions, if that woman was there and I would be raising some of these issues, like, and it was like, she didn't want to talk about those things. So at any rate, they gave the word back to them, called them together and said that, no, we can't approve it now, but if they could, this woman said, under this program, we have to, you had, you could have, if you could modify the proposal to meet our concerns and meet a deadline that was like about end of December, then, and this, you know, would give them time to try to take into consideration our concerns, put more funding into the botanical studies and support that fully, but try to delay some of this radio calling until you get some of this more basic stuff done, and not, well, they did take this and they resubmitted the proposal and went through it. This here was all done by email then. Mm-hmm. And I went through it, and she told us, you know, we had to have our vote in by such and such a time and how we should do it. So I went through the whole thing, and I said, you know, it's improved, but I still, there's some missing components, and the native thing was one of them. I thought they made it, no effort to get a native, to go and talk with the native people, or to maybe ask for a representative to be an advisor, oversight advisor, along with other faculty members on the university. And it was this guy had not enough, and he hadn't followed through on key references. So he didn't have, it was like, that was a problem nowadays. Unless you can go to a computer and internet and find a reference, any references before those things were accessible. And that time, yeah, there's a lot of, especially a lot of the reports were government reports, which aren't going to be there anyway. And you could get them if you go to the government agencies, and you could do that through email, but it was, you know, it takes a lot of effort and time. And they were teaching courses also, so you couldn't expect them to be spending full time on this. And so I said, no, I definitely could not approve it, but that I suggested that they approve the beginning of the botanical work and then asked for, gave them a chance to resubmit. Well, the problem was that this woman and the special funding that they were doing this under was a good concept because it involves the mining people, but it, and they had the money there and let's spend it because if they didn't spend it, it would go to something else and probably not supporting science. So she had a hard time getting other members to vote. And there were, out of the six, I think there were only three of us that got the votes in on time, and she didn't, she reminded us regularly, but she didn't follow up. And so she said, well, just have to go with what we have. And then she, there was some statement that we, and I could only conclude that the one non-Canadian was the one who didn't approve of it, and we'll just ignore that one. I felt like responding, but then I thought, no, I shouldn't do that. I mean,
so they approved it?
Yeah, they approved it. And Walaji was one of them that approved it, and I was disappointed, but on the other hand, I realized the awkward position he was in. And then was a third one, but there were a couple of the others, I think they didn't want to vote. And so they just didn't, and they could argue, well, I couldn't make the deadline or it's too busy. They all had other jobs, and but that's, I mean, she could have, pursued it. Mm-hmm. She wanted the thing to be, it was obvious to be approved, period. And she was an intelligent woman, but I had a lot of respect for her early on, but when it came obvious that she wanted to do that, I lost that respect. I thought, man, they're good, lucky to have a woman that's so good and good at work, getting us to work together as a group. But I felt I'd been had.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Jill had recommended me to be on the committee. That's how I got onto the committee, because she had been here and knew her well, and I felt good about that part of it. But in talking to them in the informal setting in the evening when they had a dinner, and then they took us and showed them their offices. I mean, this young guy was so focused on his PhD work, his office was loaded with hundreds of radio collars and a few horse skeleton material, and was like, he was a foreigner there in that set of situation. And he just bubbled with enthusiasm. And if I raised some questions, ecological, it was obvious. Even when he was talking about his PhD studies and that kind of situation, I'd raised some question about this, and he didn't seem to have a good grasp of the ecology there. He was focused on, you know, what you read in the Wildlife Society advertisements about radio collars, the answer to everything. And he was convinced they were the answer to everything. They're not the answer to anything unless you have hypotheses that you're going to test and you design a good scientific methodology to experiment and find out what is being done. So, and what you hope to, what kind of information you get to. Like I would raise questions that I said, well, the woodland caribou are not going to be in big groups. It seemed like he didn't know that. Well, they are in wintertime. I said, yeah, they're going to be in groups of a few animals, but not big groups. First place, they're endangered because their population is low. But their whole strategy is different than the migratory herds. They, when the they live in this country, it's not really forested country. It's open shrubland, and it's a transition zone into tundra area. And in some places, yeah, there's woodlands, and some places not. And these little isolated patches of woodlands are key places for them to go. And when females, when they're having calves, and they isolate themselves from all of the other caribou, rather than going to a calving ground, and the common calving ground. And then, didn't have any real understanding of predator-prey relationships from what it was known. And that's where there was a lot more known in Manitoba, obviously, and then there. And part of it is because they had people on the faculty who were interested, but also the state biologists seemed to be much more knowledgeable. In fact, never met any state biologists. Well, we did when we were doing this other study. I'd done a study with on co-management with Jack Cruz, and which was, you know, interdisciplinary, and we visited Saskatoon, then in Prince Albert, which is a native, primary native community in the north, and I mean, it's how you can overlook those native people, and some of them, sure. I mean, the attitude seemed to be the common redneck attitude that, oh, these people are all acculturated. They live in the cities and they don't carry on traditional activities. Well, those were the people on the road system. Whereas the ones that the study area, there's no road system. People were isolated. Mm-hmm. When we flew into some of those places in a float plane when in Manitoba, wow, it was interesting to me. The only interest in tourism was maybe a little bit of ecotourism. If they wanted to fly in, they would be guides. They had good canoes and big canoes, freighting canoes. And they, in the wintertime, those places are accessible by winter roads. They go across frozen lakes and marshes and what. And that's pretty common in Canada. But in the summer, they're isolated. So they have to bring in all the fuel, you know, and they have fuel storage bins. And many of them don't have an airport. They just have this, well, they buy land on the lake in the winter with ski planes. And the summer float planes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go back a minute to the field course you were talking about in Forbes.
Oh, sure.
Where was he from? He was a professor someplace?
He was a professor at the University of Lapland in northern Rovaniemi. But he went there under a...
But he was American.
He was originally from Maine, and he did a PhD at the University of Montreal.
Okay.
But he did his research on vehicle disturbance on the north slope of Alaska.
Okay.
Vehicle disturbance on the tundra in the summertime primarily. And so he knew people here fairly well. And then he
knew of you from past work, and he invited you to.
Well, I met him when he was here on a. I never met him when he was doing the work on the North Slope, but others did. Some people that were working with the Tulik Field Station, for example, but and others who were working on the North Slope. But when I was up there working was a little bit before he was mm-hmm. doing that work there. And then he won a young scientist award that he and several others toured around to different universities relating to Arctic and their interest areas. And then they visited Fairbanks and the UAF, and then he stopped by the office, and that's the first time I met him, I guess. And I was certainly impressed by him then, because the guy was so knowledgeable about vegetation and the tundra environment, which I was in the same areas. And then he got a 2-year two-year visiting professor kind of thing at the University of Lapland in Finland.
So he was organizing this course and he invited you to participate?
Yeah. But he, and his, you know, here he is, he's a son of the Ford family. And so after he became a professor there, he was doing this rich work in Russia, and then he got a full-time position there, which was a tough one because he wouldn't have stayed in Finland if he hadn't fallen in love with a Finnish woman.
Right.
And she was, she had a, there aren't many jobs up there in that northern Finland, but she had university training in the south, but she had, some of it was up there because she was trained in somewhat filming, I think, she got to advise and review films that were generated for varying purposes, but mostly by small groups that were putting on theatrical-based films. But then when the film industry there grew, she got a permanent position up there. And that's when Bruce met her and they decided to get married. And then he was on a 2-year visiting professor kind of thing, young professors. And he lectured in English. So they finally a full professorship opened up because he'd been doing such great research with the reindeer and had the good funding for the Russian work that was internationally funded. And he was a good professor. The students thought he was great. So he applied for that professorship, but he had to be able to teach a course in a year and a half in Finnish.
No.
So he had to learn Finnish.
It's a different
language.
That was
tough on him.
Yeah.
But he was persistent and made the grade. And then they've got 2 children and built a really nice home on the stream, got a nice sauna there that he wanted my advice when I went there about a sauna, and he'd put something together which was rather crude, and it wasn't tight enough. It was hard to get it up to temperature. But it was a perfect location, the stream that doesn't flood too much, you could go out there and waist deep and right out of the sauna. Yeah. It was a nice situation. They got quite a bit of land that included that.
And now the other instructors, the Russian and the Swedish, do you remember any of their names?
I can find them out. Okay. I've got a report on that whole thing. They put together a really nice report, a photograph and everything. I'll bring that the next time and can get the names of everybody.
Okay. Because by that point, 2000, you were retired, right?
Close to it. Yeah.
Not that you've stopped
I guess
working.
I was retired. Yeah.
Yeah, not that you've stopped working, but you were not officially employed by Fish and Wildlife anymore.
No, I mean, I was, when they asked me, I thought, that sounds like something I'd really like to do. And I talked to Heather, my partner then, who worked for the university in the greenhouse, and I said, and she had done, tied in with some Arctic vegetation work because the Agriculture and Land Resource Management under a defunct kind of guy who was in charge of their reindeer work got funding to do this study out on the Seward Peninsula. So they sent a bunch of, he hired a bunch of young, or they're all women, I think. And Heather was then working for them. She was doing editing of publications for the agriculture. She has a master's in horticulture that she got here at UAF. At any rate, I said, I'd like to do this, and I'll tell them I want you to come along, and you would be willing to organize things, which she did a good job when she was doing that. She just loved it. They called her mother. And she got along super well with all of the gals, and she's got a nice personality. So she said, no, I couldn't do that. And I said, of course you could do it. It would be a challenge, but everybody helps out on those kind of things, and you're just the kind of person they'll need. And so she agreed. And so then I wrote them this long email saying, yeah, this is conditions I can come under, and I'd like her to come, but she would be willing to do all this, and that we would pay her way and stuff coming there. Well, she got along well with all of the other faculty, especially the women faculty, and they did a great job, and the students loved her, and so it was a good deal for everybody, and I felt good about that, and it was nice that she was along.
Yeah.
It kept me from falling in love with this Russian woman.
Other work you were talking about this proposal process in Canada, so maybe we should talk a little bit about some of your own research that you've done in Canada. You mentioned Manitoba.
That was kind of a unique situation, and done that two times, I guess, once in Manitoba and once in Newfoundland. And that was associated with, in both cases, hydroelectric projects. In one case, it's mainly the power lines, and the other one, the projects and the power lines and the roading in Newfoundland. And
it was to study the impacts on the caribou?
Potential
impacts from these projects.
Right. So what they did was they wanted to get, and the environmental consulting firms that were charged with doing this assessment, the base in Newfoundland and Manitoba, they checked around who is the best qualified people in the world to do this. The Newfoundland one, there were two people. One was me, and the other was a Norwegian that I had worked with when I was over there on Fulbright and sabbatical deal, Egil Reimers, who's now, he just retired last year at 65, but he developed, he had, he, well, we published together from the work that I did over there on differential body condition, calf survival, on herds that were close to the, closer to the sea versus further from the sea in Norway. That would be in the area between Trondheim and Oslo, in those mountains, Hardangervidda mm-hmm. and others. And so he was one person that was contacted, and I was the other, asked if we would do this together as a team. Well, we contacted one another, and yeah, that sounds really interesting. So, but I mean, I couldn't do this as an individual. I said I would do it because I was an employee of the Fish and Wildlife Service and head of the Wildlife Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit. So if I did that, they had to pay my expenses of getting there when they had to do the same with the Norwegian. And he was with the university then in Norway. And so it was similar in both cases, except that he was free to take leave, and then they paid you some kind of honorarium to do this and cover all your expenses as well. And I said I could do it, but I wouldn't accept it. The honorarium, I would use the honorarium to support student projects through the Wildlife Research Unit. And then I was pretty sure that I would get approval to do that from my bosses in Washington. And I wanted it that way anyway. And so I could feel that I was helping the wildlife unit and support graduate students that way. So, that, you know, it was like each time it was not more than a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And but it was really fun in Norway, or in Newfoundland, because here a guy that I respected had been a postdoc here, and was the two of us were invited to there, and then he invited, toward the last couple of days, he invited his wife over, and so she could, they could be tourists for a little while too. Mm-hmm. And that was great. And I knew her well. And so it was nice to work together. And it was good because here we're coming with different perspectives. Because Norway, they had problems with pipelines for hydroelectric development and hydroelectric lines. And how did that affect building hydroelectric lines through both domestic reindeer areas as well as wild reindeer or caribou areas? And he was just getting started in that kind of research over there. And I had had this studies of disturbance effects up and associated with the North Slope oil development and the Arctic refuge and proposed pipelines and roads not really on power lines, but most everything else. And so that worked out well. And then the Manitoba one is, that was probably partly as a result of work in Newfoundland, but also they contacted me as an individual, and I'd go there, and they would be based what's the name of the town in Manitoba? The main town, the capital? I know it so well.
Yellowknife, no?
University of Manitoba is there.
Is Yellowknife Manitoba?
No, that's no. Northwest Territories. Oh. I'll think of it. But at any rate, and I knew Bill Pruitt, who was mm-hmm. Firecracker Boy. He worked at that University of Manitoba and did some work with Caribou and Snow. And he was getting very senior by that time, but he was still had a chance to visit with him. And then I, but I didn't have any good current contacts with biologists there in Manitoba. So, but when I, part of being there, then they, we got together, I got together with the provincial biologists who worked and got to know them. And then we, then I did this terrific helicopter trip along the whole route of the proposed power line. And, you know, that was about a day and a half, which was terrific. And then the hydro project was right up close to Hudson Bay, where a river coming into Hudson Bay would be dammed, and then the power line would come all the way down to through Manitoba to whatever the town is. At any rate, Winnipeg.
Winnipeg.
Yep, Winnipeg. And that was complex, too, because there were these problems that were peripheral problems, like you put in a power line, you have to have some kind of a, especially in the southern part, there already a problem. Here you got the, you got, again, the caribou. And the main problem they're having with the caribou is they're logging more and more of this northern boreal forest that, on the northern northern was when you get off to the prairies, it was the northern part of the boreal forest. A lot of lake country, beautiful lake country, and pristine waters and great fishing, and there was already this railroad going to from Winnipeg to all the way up to Churchill on Hudson Bay, and that was had been built years earlier to as a grain port for Manitoba, so that that could grain could be the quickest way to get grain to Europe. That way, yeah, or to the East Coast. But, so, and they had a power line along that, what, from a smaller project up there. But the power line, Manitoba Hydro, was the one that was going to build this power line. So it was a provincial company, and they didn't want to use that same corridor because it was too narrow going between lakes in one place. Mm-hmm. They have the railroad and one power line. And the reason they didn't want them together is they said it would, they want them separate because if you get icing and the power goes down, it would go, and they were right together, they'd go down. If they were widely separated, especially close to lakes, you could get a lot of fog and stuff and icing right at freeze-up. Whereas if it was away from the big lakes, Lake Manitoba, then it probably wouldn't be the same kind of weather, mm-hmm. which is probably a valid argument. But how serious was this be? Now, what the history of, they hadn't had a lot of problems. They hadn't of outages because of that.
And what year was this? You were in Manitoba and Newfoundland?
I don't know. I'll have to look it up.
Still when you were still working for Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah.
So 80s, 90s, 60s, 70s?
They were probably in the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did you study this impact? What kind of methods did you use?
When you're an expert like that, like Eigel and I in Newfoundland, they had to transfer us around, sometimes by float plane, sometimes by road, sometimes by helicopters. They took us to these, show us what was being done in the way of, they were diverting streams and creating canals. And then the questions we raising is, well, what happens when winter comes? Are these canals going to be freezing over, or is the water going to be moving fast enough that it won't freeze over? And are the canals, if a caribou gets into the canal, can it get out? Because they have to blast through rock frequently to do this. And a lot of these things they hadn't taken into consideration. And this information then would be a warning to the companies that if you want approval for this, you had to take these into consideration and have a suitable design to minimize this. It might mean you have to, in case of the canal, which might be only a few miles wide, but they would be between two lakes, and they dry up a stream, which we weren't dealing with fisheries, but sometimes we had to think about that. They have black bears, and the black bears were predator on the calves, but they didn't. The provincial government was doing studies then, which were proving that one of the first modern biologist there became an expert on caribou and did his doctoral work on that, guy named Bergerud. But he got hooked on the idea and that only serious predators, no wolves there on the caribou, were lynx. And they had introduced snowshoe hares. And I don't know about the lynx, I think they came there on their own or may have been there because they did have a native Arctic hare type there. And they had ptarmigan and other things that lynx could feed on. And he did studies which showed that when a calf is killed, how do you determine whether it was bears or lynx? Well, the problem with bears is they ate everything. and especially if a calf, they just crunched the bones and eat them up. So you didn't have the bones that were necessary. But sometimes you'd find an animal that was killed but not fully consumed. And he looked at the skulls and he could see that the things, the holes in the skulls were mostly caused by the claws of the lynx rather than the bear's teeth. And this wasn't confirmed until they put radio collars on the bears, and it turns out that the bears were killing more than the lynx were, but the lynx were leaving evidence that they killed them, whereas the bears weren't leaving any evidence of this. And so it was, again, like here, they were misjudging which were the more serious predators. But anyway, that was sort of an aside. But the roading was a big issue. I mean, when you build the roads, then people come in hunting, and what is that going to remain that way? How will this affect the movement of the caribou and their use of the seasonal habitats? I mean, obviously, if they have a hunting season, hunters will use the roads to get as close as they can, and even if they're using, say, snow machines. But they would much rather, at those times, much rather use a pickup truck and road hunt if you could get your animals that way. So there were all of these issues that we could bring up, and our job was not to draw conclusions about the project, but to point out the potential problems that had to be addressed from our perspective, and recognizing we wouldn't know everything, but we'd know more. The consulting firm would know where to look and where to put emphasis. And I was impressed by the people that were working for for the consulting firm. They were top-notch people, and they were even pretty good at modeling populations and extraneous factors and variable factors. And so they were good to work for. They respected us, we respected them. And so that was good. And the Manitoba was similar, except that was more on my own. And so I could say, which I did at times, well, Manitoba Hydro is paying for this, because that was required. If they're going to develop something, they had to pay for the environmental studies. And I said, I want to be able to ask questions to experts with Manitoba Hydro, as well as a state or provincial wildlife biologists who are more familiar with the caribou. And I don't think Canadian Wildlife Service was involved in this. It was all, I think there may have been some Canadian Wildlife Service people, and we were able to meet when we did this helicopter trip up there near Hudson Bay. We stayed overnight up there and went to these villages where the people were employed through the hydro, keeping the hydro plant going, and they were close to the railroad as well. And so their living costs weren't all that high because they had electricity, cheap electricity, and food that could come by train, like any other Canadian, mm-hmm. if living along a railroad. But they were like Alaskans, they loved to hunt and fish, and they had some native interests, not so much there in those villages. They were mostly non-natives. It was down the province was the natives that were in the interior, that not on road systems. But then there were other problems, and the Manitoba thing is that I mentioned this hogging and the caribou there in the south, the woodland caribou up at in the north near Hudson Bay. This was one of the big migratory herds that was wintering in that area, and so it was quite a different situation with regard to the caribou up north, and you didn't want these to interfere with the migration, whereas in the south, the woodland caribou, the native people claimed that clear right away, and that's going to be more non-natives coming with snow machines and hunting along the right away, and they said, so would the natives, so we would use the right-of-way. But then where the caribou are going to be over-harvested, because they traditionally had been only the natives using the caribou, the woodland caribou. And then when you make it possible, and there'd be more roading because there were a big emphasis on harvesting the wood. What did they use the wood for? Well, mostly paper pulp, because they were smaller diameter trees, but they would. There was a little bit of lumber production, and they could. I think they also harvested and could make pulp out of aspen and birch. They had a lot of aspen there after they had fires in that southern part, but. The logging had opened up the area, opened up the forests, they had fires, and because it's a fairly dry area, and a lot of the fires were started after the logging had occurred, and they were started by accidents, the loggers often, and then it would come back into second growth and be good for moose and the second growth deciduous trees were made for moose habitat. And the moose, the deer were, population was so low that there weren't many wolves. And they were so scattered, there weren't many wolves. But once you got moose up there, then the moose made it more profitable for wolves to operate in packs and increase. And they would not really focus on the woodland caribou, except that they ran into them more frequently, and then they would kill them. So there was increased predation on the per capita of the caribou, and the moose nevertheless would carry on and continue, because especially in riparian areas where they're close to streams and what. But the moose also had, no, the deer, well, it was a combination of two things. The moose brought the wolves that hammered the deer, but the deer also had a brain worm that they had adapted to. And that as the deer moved north, then the caribou, if they got the brain worm, that was lethal for them. Whereas the deer had evolved with it long enough, they lived with it. And the moose had problems with the brain worm at first, and they adapted to it. But the woodland caribou were slower to adapt because there are so few up there, and they didn't come in contact regularly, but they did. And so it was something new that they, if you're going to adapt, you've got to have a whole population clobbered, and the survivors are ones that are more adapted to it. So it was a problem of that, which was complex, and it was, main problem was, you can't just open up this country for logging because you're building roads. And then, of course, you have the hunters, just like here. Once you get a road, the hunters are going to go there. You can't keep them out, and because they're voters, and they want to be up there, and they're competing with natives, but they're over-harvesting something like the woodland caribou. And then you have the hunting and all these other impacts that come with it. And the roading was something that the native people living in those areas were much opposed to. And even in the north, they were satisfied with one highway and one railroad, and they didn't feel like they had any need for others, because the caribou were migratory, and they came down and agreed that there were winter roads, and there were minor problems with caribou in the wintertime that would use the winter roads some, and doing so they might be more vulnerable to predation, because the wolves would also use as a travel corridor, they would use that up, and they were fresh tracks, they would head off and follow them to see if they could get a kill.
Mm-hmm.
So, as usual, it was complicated,
right.
And you know, there are different interests involved, and it wasn't just native, non-native. There was some of that, but there was also people opposed to excessive killing by hunters, and especially for endangered species.
So again, you weren't going and looking at the impacts that were happening. You were looking at the questions to,
right,
see for environmental impact possibilities.
We had information about the other pipelines that existed, and where they're along a transportation corridor that was a main highway. the only highway, mm-hmm. and the railroad. And there had been problems, but those were a long time ago, and they either adapted or disappeared.
Right. So you were proposing the questions and the issues that might come up.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we were saying these are the possible ecological consequences that would be developed as a result of the project. And in some cases, they might say, well, okay, if we do this differently, we didn't build any roads, so we also only helicopters to lay the power line, which they could do, and they had to in some cases because you couldn't build roads because of so many lakes, and well, they could in the wintertime. They do it in the winter, yeah. So if they do these winter roads, they could do it and not have build a road. They could do that, and so that was an option. But then that's when the natives said, yeah, but power line right away is a cleared lane, mm-hmm. and it's great for hunting on. And no reason why the non-natives can't go to the end of the road and get on the power line. But then the logging produced the roads that encroach further and further into this pristine habitat for some people, some natives, and also for the woodland caribou.
And so were these, both of these hydro projects, were they funded and they went forward?
They didn't build that power line. They built it along the other corridor, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I think they scaled down the hydro project too, size of it. But, and the Newfoundland, yeah, they built the projects, but they did a lot of modification to minimize the impact. And the caribou there, it was different because they didn't mostly have big migratory herds there. They were kind of separate herds. And the question was, you know, are you going to have a big impact on a herd, even if it was a non-migratory herd, that was undesirable. But and we could recommend things that needed to be done, like more studies on bears and how their predation and how they might be impacted. And they use fish if fish are available, but that means the population is going to be variable too in relationship to the project, the population of the bears.
Mm-hmm.
It was the habitat there for the caribou. I'll have to admit that both Aigan and I, you know, wasn't what like we thought it would be, but nevertheless, the caribou were there. It was there's a lot of open tundra, but with bunches of shrubs. Sometimes shrubs were, what species of that was? There was some pine, but the small shrubs were alder, I think, which were not food for caribou or moose. And I don't think the moose were an issue there on Newfoundland. They hadn't been introduced there. Newfoundland is so different because of its during the full glaciation, a lot of it wasn't glaciated. The glaciers that came down over New England down to the sea. But the sea level was lowered, and so the land extended out and included the fishing grounds, the cod fishing grounds.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the early days, the cod fishermen would occasionally hook on something and bring it up, and it would be a mammoth bone.
Hmm. Out so, in the Outer Banks out there?
Yeah. Although that was dry land and there were these big mammals that were there, it was like south of the ice sheet in the lower 48 and like Alaska. It wasn't glaciated. And it turns out that the caribou on Newfoundland and that migrate up into northern Quebec, northeastern Quebec on the other side of Hudson Bay, are genetically different. So they're ones that were isolated during the last glaciation and then were able to occupy that area. And there's no brown bears or grizzly bears there, never have been, because they weren't able to get there, and the black bears were there, apparently. And the black bears there in northern Labrador and Quebec they're bigger, and they go out in the tundra and they kill caribou calves on the big migratory herds, just like grizzly bears do up in the north. Whereas if you got both grizzlies and black bears, the black bears retreat into the forest and can't be there and survive if you got a lot of brown bears around. So it's a different part of North America in that regard.
And did you do other research in Canada?
I should mention one other thing. Indigenous people on Newfoundland, it's the only place in North America where they were, that Native people were totally eliminated by the early settlers here. We were mostly fishermen, and these people weren't aggressive. They weren't very abundant. I forget what they, like Muktok or something like that. There were still a few left into the 1800s, and they died out. Of course, disease was probably the main thing that finished them off. But the Newfies are a little embarrassed about that. Not much embarrassed. But.
No. So did you do other research in Canada?
Well, then I had student projects that included work in Canada. So some studies on the porcupine herd. I had a woman student who did a master's, and she did most of her work in the Yukon. And so I was her major advisor, and Bob White, I think, was on the committee. And then the other committee member was a Canadian from Canadian Wildlife Service. And she has since worked with the Canadian Wildlife Service in Yukon. They did one of the editors for the Birds of the Yukon. But then when the caribou guy retired, she took over the caribou, and now I just learned recently that she's moved to another more administrative position. I think she's still in Yukon. She married a geologist who was also working for the Canadian government, and they raised her family there. She was a terrific, really good student and did a good job. And there's a lot of pride in what she did. The tough project was insect-related. But then I had where else? A PhD student from Quebec. And he was French-speaking, and he wanted to do a PhD here with me, but he wanted to work on caribou deer, that's right, on deer in an island in the mouth of St. Lawrence River, Anticosti Island, which is very interesting. It's sort of, in some regards, like Isle Royal in the Great Lakes, in that it had a lot of deer and I don't don't think there are any wolves there. They've been eliminated or something. And Anacostia had a lot of history of humans because right there where early settlers came and they logged hell out of it and tried agriculture, but it was better on land because there was too much. In the winter, if you cleared the land, you had too much wind and snow and ice. And I agreed to take him on, and I went out with him in the field in the winter. We had to take a ferry there, and then he had a couple of snow machines that belonged to the province, and we were able to use snow machines to get around. The snow would soften up when you get a storm, and then it would freeze hard, so you'd stay right on top. You could go everywhere on top of the snow, and the snow mm-hmm. in places was deep. And the deer had hammered the fur. The fur was a popular species for wintering by the deer. And so they couldn't start new trees because they were hammering it so hard. So he did a good study, a PhD study, and then he became a professor at the University of Laval
mm-hmm.
in Quebec City, and he invited me back there another time, and he gave some talks and what. And that's French speaking,
right.
But I didn't have to speak in French. he was a terrific guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was. We tried to get him to use skis, and we finally did. Here, but he said it was a snowshoe guy, and he was a good snowshoer.
So other projects?
Let's see.
You didn't do your own, it was all student projects.
Pardon?
You weren't doing any of your own research?
I was collecting information that could be used in some of the research, especially comparing caribou in Quebec to caribou and how they were habitat, difference in how they used their habitat. And then when he was a professor there, he invited me over a couple of times to. He was working with caribou, and they invited me over to go out with them. And then I did the same for the work in... then I had that one. That was a problem. That one was... Do you know Maria Berger?
Yes.
Yeah, she did a master's with me on bison habitat and herds out in Delta, and then she became a specialist in bison habitat, and she's one that worked out at Campton Nulli.
Right.
And so that's an interesting one.
So that was in she did work in Canada then?
She started working in Canada. So she was originally from Canada, from Ontario, and she has a German heritage, and she did an undergraduate degree there, and then she got a job. She was a beautiful young woman when she took this job to work in Northern Labrador with the Newfoundland government, not the Quebec, Newfoundland government, and they had a separate team that was working with the caribou there, and a lot of their work was, some of it was related to hydro development in Quebec as well as in and mining, in iron mining in Labrador. And visited there. I mean, you're right on the border between Quebec and Labrador, and if you're in Labrador with these Newfies, and where are you going to go for dinner? Well, we'll go down the road. It's only 15 miles. And then you're in Quebec, and, they have a wonderful food there. In the restaurant. Anyway, she worked there, and she loved the work, and they appreciated it. She was did a lot of survey work, and she was one of the observers in the aircraft, and was just super reliable. And so then the director of wildlife in Newfoundland became this young guy who was, I first met in this hydro, he was a biologist on this hydro project we were consulting on. But he was a good wildlife biologist, and he was doing this caribou, he did that study showing it wasn't lynx, it was bears that were the main predator on the young caribou. But he was a good biologist, a good scientist, but he was a sort of typical Newfie that had an ego deal about them being superior to other people. And they didn't have native people there to be superior over, so the rest of the Canadians had real pride in their heritage. But he was also pretty much a womanizer. He was married, but there'd been problems with hiring females to work with him. Well, he was the one that said, he could. She talked to him at one point about the possibility of, and I think he may have recommended it to initially, that she could do a study on one of these small herds that hadn't been much work done on. It was kind of hard to get to, but you could, it was kind of like a helicopter deal, but it was a small area. Once you get in there, you could do good work, and it would be interesting to compare it. And it sounded like a good project. And so they were going to fund her. They had the funding to do it, and they wanted her to work with me. That's right. He knew me well, and I knew him. And and the question was, she had to be admitted into a graduate program here. So she applied and was admitted. And she was so experienced that she was really a good student, but really lacked self-confidence. She wasn't convinced she had the ability to go on for an advanced degree. I mean, it was just so modest. But she was very social, and she was one that just loved us. Backcountry skiing, and she was just top-notch doing all those things and loved it. And a nice person to have with these student outings. And so then she went to St. John's to start this project. And so this guy, I'll think of his name in a minute, who was head of the, by this time, he's heading up the wildlife program there. But he's still very active, a field worker, and doing projects. And so he said, everything's on schedule. But he said, we're so busy on these other things right now. The main thing is I have to get these reports in. And if you can help us do that, we'll pay you for that time. But or that should be covered as part of her, and it was be a good learning experience for her, and then he'd get her out there. Well, it was one of those deals where he was probably very attracted to her as a young female, but she had already had experience with Novice and how to handle herself. He was really good at that. she had this reputation too, and the novice would go to the bar and drink, and here she was a smaller woman than mm-hmm. you are.
Yeah.
And the big novice, and they would swear that she drank just as much as they did, but she didn't get drunk. Anyway, she was clever, obviously, and in that regard. And so at any rate, then I had a phone call from her, or I called her, and she said, well, she's getting frustrated because she can't get a commitment as to when she can get into the field, and that's her project. And Shane Mahoney, that was his name. And Shane had her working, working up some data and stuff from other projects. She was competent in doing this kind of stuff because he'd done it before. And so, in effect, he was taking advantage of her. And so I talked to Shane and on the phone, and I said, yeah, she's frustrated because she can't get out in the field. He's a real talker. And he said, yeah, I'm trying to get out. We've had terrible weather, and I've been so busy. I just, with these other projects, and she's been so helpful in getting these done. But definitely, we've got it, and it won't, we'll still have time to carry it out. And then I didn't hear anything from her. And then I didn't hear anything from Shane either. And somehow or other, somebody who she knew here said that she just walked away. She went home to Ontario, where her father was. And I thought, this isn't the way to behave. So I didn't know what happened. I didn't know the details and anything. And finally, I figured she's going to call me, and she didn't. And so I finally found her through a student, I think, a phone number of her father, and called and got hold of her. And she said she's so embarrassed that she hadn't called me. She'd become totally frustrated, and that it was obvious she wasn't going to get out in the field, and Mahoney was just taking advantage of her. She hadn't, hadn't been harassing her sexually, but he was hoping to break her down, probably. and she knew about his problems in that regard because she knew other people there. Mm-hmm. And other people were beginning to say, students too, you can work with that guy, and female students, And so at any rate, she tried to get him to make a commitment to getting out in the field, and he realized it was going to, and he would say, well, next summer we'll be able to handle it, it's not a big deal, that kind of thing, So he acknowledged, but I need you here. So she just walked away, which was probably the best thing for her to do under the circumstances, but why didn't she call me? Why didn't she talk to me and tell me what she'd done? And so then when I got her on the phone, she was apologetic, but she said, it was too much for me. And she said, I couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. I said, well, I understand that, but you made a commitment and to me, and where does that leave us? And she says, I'm not coming back. I'm going to drop out completely. I said, well, look, you were doing good work here. I don't see why you have to feel that way. He says, well, I'm not going to go back there. And I says, okay, I don't think I want you to go back there, but we'll maybe we can find something else. It creates a problem financially, but we'll work something out. You already had at least a semester and maybe two. And so finally she said, okay, she would come back. And I said, well, we'll look around and see what we can put together. And so before she got back, I had talked, the Fish and Game had mentioned an interest in somebody to work, a student to work with the bison, and it would be heavily based upon vegetation. And she was had these qualifications. She had a good background in plant, and she was interested in it. So when she came back, we talked about it, and I said, you know, we're still scraping for funding, but Fish and Game has agreed to come up with the logistics support and some other support, and the logistics support would include, you know, aerial flights and things like that, but she would have to, they would provide some of the field gear, like she had to cross the river with herself and an assistant and work on the other side where these gravel bars where the bison were spending the summer, which are a lot of grassland. They're hard to get to, but once you get over there, you can just camp. It's tricky crossing that river with a inflatable boat.
This is the Delta River?
Yeah, and multiple channels. So you have to be prepared to drag the canoe down on the gravel bar until you find a place where you can safely get across, quickly paddle across, and then get out, and you got boots, and so you can get out, and you got to learn something, know something about the river and things like that. So I think they got her over there once with the helicopter the first time, but she said, no, she has to be over there and camp over there if she's going to do this, which was reasonable, and she was eager to do that, and so we equipped her and got a female student that was top-notch, and they worked well together, and they were super good at handling the duff, river crossing and stuff. The second summer, we had a volunteer from Norway, a young guy, a student. He was, I think, a senior. He had volunteered to come and do work at the wildlife unit. Well, normally we'd use our own students if we had, but we didn't. We asked Maria if she could use another person. She says, yeah, they could definitely use it. But it wouldn't be all that exciting because there'd be a lot of vegetation work and stuff. So this young Norwegian came, and he was frightened about crossing this river and was trying to give advice and didn't want to cross. And Marie said, look, we can call up and have you get picked up, but we have to get across, and we know how to do it. And but you have to take instructions on where to paddle. And this was hard for this guy to take instructions from a woman. And they got across okay. And then it was the same in the field. At first, you know, he would thought he knew a better way of doing things than they did, and especially than she did. No, she said, I'm in charge here. He thought he was lucky to go out with these two attractive women, and his macho-ness didn't pay off.
No, he was so put in his place.
When they came back, he came into the office and he sort of apologized a little bit. There was some humility there, he said, I'd really like to get out in the field again. And I said, well, would you go out with them again? And I said, I'd already talked to Marie, and Marie said, yeah, if he's willing to come out and work, that's okay, we can handle it. And we really don't need him. And so he finally decided not to go out. And I think he got out for a few days on another project, and then he decided to go back to Norway. But it was interesting. And she certainly proved herself again. But she had to get her to make a presentation in the class about her project when all the, it was like a seminar class that I was responsible for, and all the students, they weren't all mine, but some of them were, and she was, and they had to do a presentation on their project. And I can't do that. I've never done that in front of people. Like, I can't do that. And I said, well, that's part of the project. Others are doing it. Okay, you know. But she got so uptight that the last minute, about a week before, she was so good at socializing with other grads, and we had a kind of a unique guy, grad student, who was a senior, almost a senior guy. He had worked for the Montana or Idaho game department, and he'd done a lot of bear handling, he'd been married and divorced. He was bordering alcoholic, and he decided he wanted to come and get a master's here, and I think he wanted to kick the alcohol too, and which he pretty much did, and not without some help. But anyway, the other students loved him, but he loved to go Friday afternoon after the seminar to go down to the pump house and have beers, and the beers were pretty mild for him. But the other students loved him, but they wouldn't. He went on, once he get drinking, he wanted to stay there and have a big drunk. And the students, fortunately, both sexes would say, no, we got to have other plans for tomorrow. I want to get out in the field and to enjoy things and what. And so when Marie had her chance or time to make her presentation, the word came back to me by some of the students that she said she's not going to do it. She's not going to do it. She can't bring herself to do it. And so I left a note for her to come and talk to me. And she said, no, I don't think I can do it. And it's just the way I am. And I said, but look, you've got everything going for you. You're doing a fine job, and your terrific job on the research, and your grades are top-notch, and you like it here. And she says, yeah, that's all true, but I just, this is the way I am. And so I said, I tried to say, well, practice and make your presentation in front of other people, other students, and which I recommended the others to do it too. And so the day of the deal, she had told the students, she decided it was too much stress for her to handle. But it was this older guy, drinking buddy, he set her down and he said, you know, you got to do this. And, you know, sometimes I go through the same thing myself when I was younger. And you got to do it. And you do it once, and it's pretty, you're never over it completely. And I told her, no, I get nervous when I'm up talking. It's just, and he talked her into going through it. And she did a reasonable job, you know. When she started in, you know, the color, she was getting this color coming all over her neck and everything. But she kept going, and then finally she got into it, and She was did a fine job, and see afterwards she sort of she came back and thanked me and thanked him very much that he had helped her get through it. And that then I realized, you know, how much the students support one another and how important it is. And this guy eventually we had two PhD students coming from Norway, from a university, this agricultural college, where we had good connections. And Bob White was teaching a course in radioisotope use for tracing animals, experimental animals, and they would be the potential to do that over in Norway. One was part Sami, one quarter, I think, and Sil could sort of identified herself as a, and they're both beautiful Norwegian women. The Sami woman, dark hair, and the other one, a beautiful Scandinavian, tall, big, beautiful woman. And he fell in love with the Scandinavian, and another, a PhD student of Bob White's, fell in love with the other gal. And he did a master's, and they went to Rhode Island, and then I think when that happened, she decided, the Sami woman, to know she was going to go back to Norway. Well, the other one, she was going back to Norway, and this guy went back with her, married her, they started a family, and he had to learn Norwegian. He got a job at a Norwegian sort of high school and working with training that he got in Alaska, as well as his other experience. Mm-hmm. And I visited them a couple of times, and they hit it off great. And he was very supportive of her, and she got her PhD and got a good job.
It's amazing how much you stay in contact with your students, and you know what's happened to them since and where they've gone and the families, and you
well,
still see them.
And I have to explain that to people like Miranda, who was here with her husband. Yeah, I mean, I was in love with her just like I'm in love with my daughters. It's like a filial love. And I had to rationalize that myself. I mean, as a professor, especially because I was attracted to them as women too. But then when you're a professor, you got to face up to the fact that it's inappropriate to have a sexual love affair with your students, which is very easy to do with such beautiful young women. And so and of course our wives were very concerned about that too, and didn't like the idea that more and more women were coming into wildlife. And even Fred Dean was the same thing. I mean, he took on, I think, the first woman grad student in wildlife. And
because the concern was you'd be going out in the field with them as well.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, in those days, you know, what are they going to do in the field? How are you going to do field trips with guys and gals? Dale Guthrie went through that, and he had this beautiful woman that he obviously was attracted to, and he was had divorced, but she knew her way around, and he's like me, you know. He's always interested in social behavior of humans, and when you went out with a bunch of students or at a faculty meeting, Dale and I would be, you know, we would be looking at the behavior of all these other faculty, and we'd see everything, you know, that they wouldn't see, you know, the ones that were
tapping their feet.
Yeah. Yeah, and they didn't realize that that we were doing this analysis. At any rate, we're interested in Dale, especially. He was very interested in the evolution of human behavior, and he wrote books on that.
Right.
And we discussed a lot of that. And at one time, there were two guys in the psychology department, I think it was, that we had some interaction through the faculty senate or something with one of, maybe me and, or maybe probably both of us. And so then we got friends with them, and they were interested in human behavior too. And they were also doing research with behavior of pigeons and things like that. And these guys they thought, well, maybe we can get some funding. We go to one of these conferences where they're mostly wildlifers or biologists. And then we collect data on how these people respond behaviorally differently, humans do differently, et cetera, et cetera. And they asked us about this because they knew we were interested in it. We said, yes, no reason why you can't do that. And these aren't closed meetings. And Dale and I had done something similar once when we were new faculty members. We got interested in, this, at that time, we just made the assumption that most faculty in the biological sciences were believed in evolution. And of course, this was back in the days of male dominance, it was like, and nobody likes to be, no humans like to be studied. They don't like to be, especially behavioral studies. I mean, there's biologists around the field studying the behavior of all these animals, and some of them, the students come and they definitely want to study animal behavior. Well, humans are animals, but that's not right. Well, it's not right if you're religious at all. And if you're religious at all, you have a hard time dealing with evolution. And so you just don't talk about it. So Dale and I started at this time before these two psychologists did their study. But we thought, well, let's do a survey of attitude of faculty in the sciences versus the humanities. And, we sort of speculated what we'd find here on UAF campus, but we said we can't do that kind of study here because they all know us and they're not going to be free to answer questions. So we did this. We contacted, we wanted to do another state university similar to this, but they were all bigger than us in terms of faculty, which is okay. And but you can't do that kind of thing without getting approval of the administration at that university. So we wrote to, I think it was Montana State at Missoula, and which had similar offerings in the humanities and the sciences. And we developed this questionnaire, and we had a couple other people look at it, but it was very long. You had to be able to sit down and probably take you, if you did it well, 30 minutes minimum. But we tried to make it interesting and tried to not put in our own biases in there, and we knew that, you know, you got to, if it's going to be objective and it's talking about human social behavior, there's going to be a problem, but let's give it a try. And so we, in those days, you had to do a mimeograph and things. We didn't have the printing operation, but we put this thing together, and I've still got a box of with it and somewhere with all of the returns we got. And I forget how many we sent out, but we sent it to all of the faculty there at Montana State, and I guess they had to be regular faculty, and we had all these questions, and we started out with just questions about their education and training and background, and then toward the end we started getting into whether they were churchgoers or their family had been churchgoers. And then finally, then we asking them how they felt about, do they believe in evolution, and what else? We didn't have the, I think that was mainly the evolution thing. But it, of course, a lot of the questions were lead up, went, and including ecology and understanding natural selection, and actually questions: do they really believe in evolution, or do they believe in it, but are they still believe in their church beliefs, or what? Mm-hmm. Trying to find out what their church belief was, whether church accepted evolution. Anyway,
what were the results of their analysis?
Well, it took a while, and we had some kind of follow-up that we sent. I don't remember the percent results. It was about 25%, I think. But I'm pretty sure it was about that. But
25% what?
25% returned.
Oh, okay.
Questionnaires, because it was strictly up to them whether they wanted to answer. And nobody, you know, responded saying, I'm not going to answer anything like this. They just don't answer.
Right.
You just push it aside.
So of the ones returned, do you remember what your
results
were?
Well, what we found was that there were a surprising number of people in the biological sciences that didn't believe in human evolution. But I don't know what that was, the proportion, of course. And so that still meant that the highest number of people of faculty were in the biological sciences. And in the physical sciences, it was very low. In the social sciences, well, we didn't... It was low. It was low in everything. In humanities, lowest. And I don't know whether we had much in the social sciences.
You mean the humanities, the lowest number of people who did not believe in evolution?
Pardon?
So the humanities had the lowest number of people.
This wasn't anything we would put in a book.
No.
Because we didn't do any more follow-up on this. I think interesting. I mean, I wanted to at least do an analysis, but that would have taken quite a bit of our time. And if we were going to do anything with it, we had to deal with the small return of the questionnaire, and then how much value can you put on this? Where there are people that were, even evolution didn't return it because they were busy. And some faculty members are, I'm one of them, that the questionnaires are so time-consuming, and I've got these other things I'm working on.
Right.
And so...
Or also maybe the ones who believed in evolution were offended by the questionnaire and wouldn't answer it.
Yeah.
There was all kinds of
I didn't factors. Think we should be asking questions about religious
right.
beliefs. Sure, there's a lot of all kinds of reasons that could do that. And this was so damn much social science for both of us. We figured, well, it was a good exercise. And we had some satisfaction of doing it. But let's get on. And both he and I were super busy and were, and Dale was going ahead writing a lot on, starting to write a lot on primate behavior leading up to humans as higher primates.
Well, but it's interesting back to about your students. And then is it typical for faculty to stay so connected to their students and follow their lives and their careers?
It's different. Some of the faculty do that, but they were faculty who didn't have as many students as I had. So, I had like 66 students that actually got degrees under me, and more of them, a few didn't make it or dropped out of their own accord. And I was on graduate committees for hundreds more. So that in the Sam Bishop's write-up, it makes the point of the 66 students, and that included masters and some
10 PhDs. Is that a lot for a faculty person to have had that many?
It's unbelievably high because the uniqueness I had was I was full-time employed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. Most faculty in those early days had 6 months, had 12, 9 months salary. In the summer, they were without salary unless they brought in funding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're teaching, it's hard to write proposals to justify funding, and the funding that would have to include your summer salary. Well, some people were employed at that time by the research institutes, and they were full-time research, but they were good at bringing in research. And so the topic was a hot ticket item, and they were fully funded. They didn't have to teach. Well, some of them wanted to teach. If they were fully funded, they could buy out their
teaching time.
Buy out, if they were fully funded, they could buy out their teaching time, but even that, they could say, postpone the research or move it if they wanted to teach, but frequently they could buy out. And because some of them did want to teach, and some of them had to teach full time. And work in the summer teaching, summer sessions and stuff if they wanted to, if they were raising a family and trying to build a home and get settled in.
So what you're saying is you had more time to get to know your students? You were more connected?
That's part of it, but it was my job to advise students and take them on. And I, as a wildlife unit person and as a unit leader, I had administration for the unit, which I wanted to minimize as much as possible. I had a secretary who handled the accounts at first, as well as being a secretary. And I then had, there was just one person at first, and then I had an assistant unit leader coming later with same constraints on them. And then my job was to help bring in money to support students. Some of it came in as part of the agreement. The Fish and Game contributed about $25,000 at that time to support strictly for students upon stipends or student research.
So you really got to know the students and their research projects.
Well, as an advisor, I believe that I wanted to, if it was in the field, I wanted to get out and the first time they're out in the field, and especially students, a large percentage of them didn't have the experience in Alaska. Most of our students were coming from outside of Alaska, or the ones in Alaska were might have some outdoor experience and a little bit of understanding, but in the winter, they didn't have much winter understanding because they're in school themselves. And that I took over some of the questions on winter ecology that other faculty couldn't take, and they had this attitude that's, including the wildlife unit at first, when I was first here, was the unit leader, his specialty was wetlands and waterfowl and some fur bearers, wetland fur bearers. And so I was one of the first students who I was accepted as a grad student without funding for the first year, but I wanted to come back so bad that I was accepted by the then unit leader, which was Neil Hosley, and he was only unit leader for 2 years, and then they offered him the deanship.
Right.
And he was a senior guy who had done a lot of good research in Michigan on Upper Peninsula on moose habitat relationships. So he understood my interest, but when he accepted me, it was just accepting, so he didn't nail me down to anything. So then when I arrived, the guy that he had hired, the university had hired to teach wildlife courses, John Buckley, when the Hosley moved to the deanship, right, he then became unit leader, and he was a good person to do it because he had 2 years of experience in Alaska, and he had started research out at Mineral Lakes, and he was a young PhD, but he was had some experience, and he rose to the occasion.
It sounds like you had such good mentors as a student that you wanted to do the same for your students. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but I was just finishing this deal about I wanted to study, because when I first came, I worked down on the Kenai, and I was interested in alpine flora and fauna, and especially mountain sheep and mountain goats. And mountain sheep and mountain goats were down there. There were moose down there, and there were no deer. And I was working mostly for the refuge, but the refuge was supporting one of the biologists with the Fish and Wildlife Service. They partitioned things on the basis of species. So the other guy that I had me do some work down there was Bob Scott, who was a mountain sheep specialist.
Right.
And he was actually had started a PhD at the University of British Columbia that he never finished because he was so busy. And he had a master's degree from Oregon State, and he was fascinating. And he's a brilliant guy, and so I worked for him. And then after that, spoiled me for wanting to work with anything else. But I'd given up a full scholarship I was told I was a finalist, and that looked like I was going to get an offer at Idaho State on sage grouse studies. And I thought, well, I could live with that in Idaho, but it wasn't really, sage grouse wasn't what I was interested
in. Alaska's better.
I was already, and after I spent the summer on the Kenai and work doing mountain sheep work for Bob Scott, oh man, but wildlife unit students didn't tackle anything that was one of the subject areas of the Fish and Wildlife Service biologists. So unless it was a segment of it, like moose, then you could do some, say, you look at here in interior Alaska, what about this mining and how did that affect winter browse activity? things like that. Could do those kind of things. And of course, I was spoiled too. I wanted to do wildlife work in the wild. And so it was obvious that mountain sheep, I was so fortunate to be able to do this and continue to do it as a grad student. But then I figured mountain goats. Nobody was working on mountain goats. There was only one paper, one thesis done on mountain goats, and that was in Idaho, I think. So I figured, well, I could do that. I could handle that. Because when I first came, you know, I was pretty naive about a master's degree, and, you know, there wasn't, most people didn't go on for a master's. And at the University of Connecticut, there might have been one or two going on, but I think they were, you could get hired with a bachelor's degree and move up pretty rapidly. There were one or two in forestry I know got, and then it was at other universities, and the University of New York at Syracuse had a couple of students that were doing masters. Mm-hmm. And other wildlife units masters, maybe a rare PhD. But if you went like the Brenna Kessel, she did a PhD in biology and ornithology at Cornell. Mm-hmm. But she taught, you know, mammalogy and ornithology and wildlife related courses. And then they hired the writer from Homer, now lives in Homer.
Reardon. Jim Reardon.
Yeah. And so at any rate, now we can go to where you wanted to go.
Which was just to conclude the topic about the students, and that it seems like you really are attached to your students and care a lot about them. And is that typical? Yeah.
But these are things that were happening to me. So I now, in retrospect, I can say these things, but I may not have thought of it this way. I'm sure I didn't at the time. When I was here and everything went so well for me, in terms of my own education, that when I came to be and get this job as wildlife unit leader, it was sort of like, that's my goal in life, and how did it happen? I was very modest, and I still am, and I didn't think, I felt, oh man, this is a real challenge for me, because I have to rise to the occasion. I was working sort of borderline. When I took that position, I still hadn't finished writing up the thesis on the deer ecology work for the University mm-hmm. of British Columbia. I took the job starting in 62, and I defended the thesis in 63. So I had to finish writing here. So I didn't have the confidence of having completed the PhD. And there was could I handle it as a married with two young kids, and the third one just about started. And so here I was having the opportunities that I never thought I would have when I was in Connecticut. But it was more than that. Can I rise to the challenge? And then I realized that early on, I mean, I was obviously had support of other faculty and as members of committees, but since I was the one, even as a brand new faculty member, but most of them were too, and that weren't through the unit, and they were envious that I had a full-time job, and some of them didn't want to take on grad students. There wasn't much of a graduate program because they didn't get salary for teaching graduate level courses. They only got salary for teaching undergraduate level that led to the bachelor's degree. And so the wildlife unit program sort of broke the ice, and I was a major player then in the development of the graduate program. But I was not only the major player, but after a while, and I got more self-confidence, I realized that I could have more influence on the development of the program, the graduate program. And so I could work for money that that maybe another the topic that was not in my field, which at the beginning I took on all these projects, student projects that were sometimes duck related, sometimes marine mammal, and sometimes vegetation, and because there was nobody else to take them on. And then you could get other faculty be committee members, but they didn't have the job of, you know, handling all of this, advising the students, be sure. And the wildlife unit was strong in requiring students to do, early on, it was like monthly reports for students. That's what I had to do when I, and sometimes, and they had to put out a quarterly report, and then, you know, it was quarterly reports, I guess. And then finally we broke that down to yearly reports for the students so that we'd have some record of progress, because there was no graduate dean or graduate program to set standards and progress for graduate students. Now it is in the university, and it's not so much on the shoulder of the professors. So it was easy for students to not make any progress if the professor was busy doing other things, and that while they were funded, the students were funded and taking courses, there was this attitude, only took, you automatically got it after you've been here for a while. But then there's still this degree situation. We couldn't, then early on, only a master's, we didn't offer PhDs because it was not qualified. The university wasn't in biology and wildlife or any programs at the university. There was an occasional oddball one through one of the geophysical institute, for example, like the Japanese guy who was retired from
Akasofu,
right? And they actually were one or two done through the Institute of Arctic Biology, and they were at odds with the biology and wildlife department because they didn't want to have to go through the standards for the department, it was sort of like the old European system where you work in research for so many years and you write a thesis and then you award them a degree. And so it was, coming to, and that wasn't unique to this university. It was common in other state universities.
So when was the PhD program started for wildlife?
I can't tell you that, but it was probably wasn't until about the late 70s or early 80s.
Okay.
And so then, but That's like a minimum of 3 years without a master's. Well, and right away the department felt insecure, and the best way is to require a master's in wildlife, a master's first, and then PhD. Well, nowadays it's not. You outstanding applicants with outstanding background can go on to a PhD. The problem with that is the master's was sort of a training ground. If you're going on for a PhD, and your chances of doing a good job are much better. And some of the students who did master's, you know, people would say, well, they produced such a wonderful master's that, and did excellent field work, et cetera, and did a good analysis at PhD level. Well, they'd say, you know, we ought to apply and see if we can get an exception and get the PhD instead of the master's for that student. I said, no, that, what kind of precedent is that set? And why shouldn't other faculty be able to do the same thing for their students? And then when, if it's just a faculty member, major advisor that's doing that, that's not the way a graduate program should work. That's too much favoritism, and that leading back to why were there any others faculty, like the guy I taught who married woman, an Upiat woman from Barrow.
Oh, Steve McLean.
Steve McLean was, he graduated from, was it Berkeley, I think? And so he said, and there was sort of this attitude that was the top-notch school for ecology and biology in the U.S., in some ways, it was justified. And he graduated in, and it was in ecology. And he did a lot of his research was shorebirds and insect productivity up on the tundra. He was an excellent scientist, and he's one of the best ecology teachers we had. Although he occasionally got real poor student evaluations if the level of understanding of the students was low, they never connected with him. And he wasn't good at connecting with people that weren't very bright. And it's a problem at a state university. But the students that were bright, he treated them super well. And the graduate students he had, and he did a good job. He frequently had some research funding, but sometimes he would take on others if there were through the wildlife unit. But he had a really close relationship with his students. And so they were sort of, you know, like me. I mean, he was like me in some regards. He saw them as, you know, some young, like he wasn't old enough to have his own kids that big, but he was treating them like almost like a son or a daughter, and he certainly favored the son approach. But he changed with time too, and so he would instead of doing when I'd do a potluck. That was a potluck for essentially all grad students who wanted to come. And some of these were students who would go out on the ski trips that were not, they weren't in wildlife program. They're in biology mostly. And occasionally there were somebody, especially overseas students, that were maybe in some other area. And so to me, it was good to mix students, not just your own students. Where Steve tended to, they had a potluck or a dinner or his handful of students there in his home, which is really, it was nice to do that. It did a lot. And where some faculty members, you know, wouldn't do it. And I remember there maybe one fairly young faculty members that thought that there was something wrong with the salary system because they don't give you enough to put on these dinners for the students. And early on, yeah, if you'd, the potlucks weren't, it was hard to do, couldn't do potlucks when students went at first because the students had no way of doing the food. We would, maybe peanut butter and crackers in there. Right. If you were staying in the dorm, you didn't have potlucks. And the, you know, a major advisor invited the students, but it was the leader of the wildlife unit. He didn't discriminate against and only favor his own students. Any wildlife students were the only one graduate students at the time, and they were there, and there were, you know, there was like a wildlife club, which included all of the and some of the undergraduates, but you know the faculty would be involved in that, including Ivor Scarlin and Otto Geis. They just loved us. They were right. Bachelors, and they enjoyed us coming to a game dinner, and which we enjoyed putting on, and was open to families and the whole works. And so it was a good environment, and part of it was a small university.
Right. I think some of it may be also a testament to you that your students appreciated you and found you to be a good mentor, and so it was a mutual back and forth relationship.
It is, and I'm sure that's part of it, but it's also that when I was advising students that were doing a study on seals off of Kodiak Island or sea lions off in Prince William Sound and a rookery there, I had to learn as much as I could. I wanted to, and because how could I advise them if they came to me and had questions about what they're finding? And if I was familiar with it, and especially when if I was going out in the field with them, I never felt like I was giving them all I could. But then I realized in retrospect that we talked about it, and that's what they needed, and that everybody should have the humility to be in a learning environment. And so I've always felt that, you know, I've always been a student myself, and I want to learn as much as I can about the world. Like if I go out for a walk by myself, I mean, I come back having learned something that I didn't expect to learn. And I feel good about that because I'm curious and ecologically curious. And the two concept of ecology and evolution go so much together. I mean, why are these birds that I see out here doing these things that they do that are very strange? And how can they do it? And why? I mean, I have to come up with a hypothesis. And then further observations, I either sort of strengthen my hypothesis or I change it. But I've been watching one of the chickadees has this over long beak on the top, and it looks so helpless, and it's so flimsy, and it's been a problem in Anchorage a lot.
Yeah,
coming to bird feeders. And I, you know, had all these different hypotheses and asked Audubon people, friends and former students of ours down there, they just didn't want to accept that maybe it's related to being fed so much artificial food. And I just said, no, it couldn't be that. I said, hey, don't say it couldn't be. You haven't found anything else that you can... Well, isn't that a hypothesis? It should be tested. And, well, it's something you could test, but not easily. But if you have you can do it. And at any rate, now I was just saw this when I saw one last year. I don't know whether it's the same one, but I saw this one and I thought, oh man, that's probably not long for this world. And then I looked at it and the feathers and everything, it looked okay. Or if the feathers get kind of gruffy looking, you figure it might be having a hard time, but it looked okay. And then I saw it coming there and, well, how's it going to feed there? I'm taking up a sunflower seed. Sunflower seed. Now, a lot of people are feeding shelled sunflower seeds. Oh. So the birds don't have to do that, you know. Saying, look, come on, the birds have to use their beak and pecking away. And that, what about the woodpecker?
Right.
You want to stop them from pecking away? So at any rate, I saw this thing. It comes with others, so it must not be too bad off. And I saw it going to that feeder and turning its head sideways because it couldn't pick up a sunflower seed, and it did pick up a sunflower seed and flew away with it. Well, I don't know how it got into it. I thought, well, maybe it's got strong jaw muscles like the Red Bulls can keep squeezing it, and finally it'll crack. But they got shorter beak and strong jaw muscles. So and chickadees, no, don't seem to be built that way. And they pick away, and then they finally get it to crack, and then they can get into it quickly and do it. And they have to have it against a hard surface. Mm. Well, it's hard to do that with this curved beak. But then it comes, I put the suet up. It came to the suet more frequently than others, and I saw that thing tearing away in the suet, and it's using that curved beak to drag it out where the other chickadees. Getting much more effective than the other chickadees, getting the suet out, almost better than the gray jays, you know. They're not as big, but there was no weakness there. I mean, it's powerful, and it wasn't breaking it.
It's adapted for eating suet.
Well, it could be. You can come up with a hypothesis of adaptation. Maybe it's species change we're seeing that... chickadees adapted to do? They've got this much more pointed beak than, say, red poles and grosbeaks that are obviously seed or fruit eaters in the wintertime. And the chickadees don't go for fruit and stuff like that. But what are they doing when they're not coming to the feeders? And they were here before we started putting the feeders up.
Right.
And well, what they do is they're mainly mining insect larvae or overwintering mosquitoes, adult mosquitoes, under the bark of mainly white spruce. But some of it's under others. Mm-hmm. But bark of white spruce is more shaggy. And they reach in there and grab these overwintering mosquitoes. They're in there and are... They've got antifreeze in them so that if they don't get eaten by a mosquito, they'll be coming out in the spring. But, and then there's all kinds of pupa of other insects that pupate and over the winter in that form. And they're in there, like the spruce budworm, I think. And so they're playing an important role, and this is high quality food. And you think one mosquito, but no, that's going up on the trees and they don't peel the bark off, they reach in there. And what other birds that do that are the brown creeper. It has a curved beak. Mm. So it's even more adept to pulling out. But it doesn't do as well here as chickadees with shorter beaks on average. But they're here. And it's the one that goes up the tree, whereas the nuthatch goes down the tree when it's feeding. And they're both and the nuthatch has stronger beaks too. They're both doing similar things, but not quite the same. So
we'll have to see what happens with that curved beak one.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I probably won't see what happens because it'll be gone. It's like, I don't know whether I told you this, but I told it to somebody else. Seeing this kind of snow this deep, the voles are doing very well, and it hasn't been all that cold.
Because we only have about 3 inches of snow.
Yeah, but they're living under the snow mostly, and they can go through the snow because it's not crusty or what. And they excavate. They're digging, excavating quite a lot.
I have voles underneath my bird feeder.
But, yeah, and that's what they're doing. And I had one on the windowsill feeder, a little one guy. And I figured it was the last of the litter. But he didn't have much fear. I figured it was male taking high risk. And so at any rate, and I see him down on the ground, and I could identify him for a while. He's a risky one. And I saw him taking a real risk. And I think they're harrying the chickadees when they come. I can't hear their chickadees, but there's a high pitch in the snow. They can. I'm sure they can hear them. And they come out when the chickadees are there. Well, that makes sense because chickadees come in numbers. If a hawk comes, they scatter, and the hawk has a hell of a time getting it. And they're going to be, they're joining in. It's like when chickadees come, frequently, nuthatches, if they're here, they'll come with them or other birds. And they do this. They get together because predator avoidance. Well, and when I see one vole, usually the three or four are out at the same time while the chickadees are there. If I'm looking, sometimes if I just go out and look and I figure, well, a vole will come out pretty soon. Sometimes one will. But it's usually when chickadees, I look, and they're down there. Well, you can say they're out because the chickadees are knocking seeds down. That's not the main factor, I think. It's because
the predator.
Yeah, and they're more brave. They're out on top of the snow, and they're going through tunnels and coming around and having a great time. And this one of them was working. It was just a little one, again, working its way directly under the deal, and the red squirrel came doing the same thing, because here are all these, and they were picking up white spruce seeds that settled down too. So they're down there, and you know, you see they get one, and for a chickadee, that they don't mostly don't go on the ground to do this. Mm-hmm. They're mostly, occasionally they would, but rarely, whereas the red poles used to do that a lot. But the voles are this one vole is working underneath, and it seemed to be preoccupied with finding something, and then it'd go on. And this red squirrel is coming from this direction, and it cut out of the corner of my eye, and it's coming out because if the chickadees are eating something, there must be food available too. They're not after the chickadees. They're after food, just like the vole is.
Right.
But it's on the ground, and this vole is working there, and it's not paying attention to this squirrel that is not paying attention to it, probably because the vole figures, well, I'm going to leave before it gets close, and the squirrel figures, it'll never stay there. I mean, it won't have a chance. I'm after seeds and feed to seeds that I can get that are dropping off. And so I'm reading, you know, what they're thinking. And they are thinking. So then it gets close. And finally, just as vole looks and starts heading away, the squirrel is so close. It's something like click, it becomes a carnivore. And it tries.
Really?
It tries to go for it and get it. And it, I figured it had it. I figured this thing couldn't get away. But it immediately dived into the snow.
The vole did.
The vole did. And the squirrel grabbed and it missed it because it was, it probably went diagonally when it.
Right, into its tunnel or something.
And then it tried to find it again, but by this time the squirrel, the vole had got stayed under the snow.
But, squirrels are not predators.
They can be predators. It's sort of like ground squirrels on the North Slope. They get run over by the truckers or on the haul road, and they come out there and eat the. That's good protein.
Right, but they're not. They didn't kill the.
Pardon?
The squirrel is being a scavenger in that case. But they have a squirrel actually go
That's
after
true.
And kill.
That's true, and it's they would be, cannibalistic, which usually is avoided. So they. But once the thing is dead and
but
run
to have
over,
a squirrel go after a vole seems very strange.
If you're interested in high-quality food, then after it's run over and doesn't look like a squirrel anymore, it's not a squirrel.
Right, that makes sense to me, but a squirrel going after a live vole.
Okay, then I have to tell you other observations I have. Ned told me about...
Maybe we should turn this off.
Yeah.